Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
With the changes to how Canadians are able to access journalism on social media, you'll always be able to find news you can trust on the CBC News app. Get your news without restrictions. Download the free CBC News app today.
The Global Story is the podcast helping you make sense of the news. Join me, Katya Adler, every weekday as I take a closer look at the stories making the headlines with insights from the BBC's global network of experts. Search for The Global Story wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Brandt, and in the early hours of Friday, the 1st of December, these are our main stories. The US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, has urged Israel to do more to protect civilians if it restarts its attacks on Gaza after Thursday's release of hostages. Delegates at the UN's climate summit have agreed to start paying millions of dollars to countries hit by natural disasters that are linked to global warming. And a court in New York has reimposed a gagging order on Donald Trump, banning him from criticizing court officials in his civil fraud trial. We begin in the Middle East, where the US Secretary of State has warned that Israel must take effective steps to ensure the protection of civilians in Gaza before it restarts its military operations there. Antony Blinken, who's on another visit to the region, outlined to reporters at a press conference in Tel Aviv the measures he was calling for.
That means taking more effective steps to protect the lives of civilians, including by clearly and precisely designating areas and places in southern and central Gaza where they can be safe and out of the line of fire. It means avoiding further significant displacement of civilians inside of Gaza. It means avoiding damage to life-critical infrastructure, like hospitals, like power stations, like water facilities. And it means giving civilians who've been displaced to southern Gaza the choice to return to the north as soon as conditions permit. There must be no enduring internal displacement. All of this can be done in a manner that still enables Israel to achieve its objectives. Of course, we know that every one of these elements is made more complicated by the fact that Hamas intentionally embeds itself with civilians, within and below hospitals, schools, apartment buildings, refugee camps. But Israel has one of the most sophisticated militaries in the world. It is capable of neutralizing the threat posed by Hamas while minimizing harm to innocent men, women, and children. And it has an obligation to do so.
Antony Blinken speaking in Tel Aviv. Well, on Thursday, he met with Israel's Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. Mr. Blinken has also been pushing for the continuation of a temporary ceasefire between Israel and Hamas that so far has lasted 7 days. He said this had allowed the doubling of aid, though this was still not enough. Mr. Blinken also demanded that Hamas immediately release all hostages and stop using them as so-called human shields. On Thursday evening, the Israel Defense Force said 6 people had been freed by Hamas. Earlier in the day, 2 Israeli women were also handed over. 30 more Palestinian prisoners are due to be released from Israeli jails in return. I heard more about all of this on Thursday evening from our correspondent Paul Adams, who's in Jerusalem.
This is the latest and potentially the last group of hostages to be released in this phase. A total of 8, 2 were released earlier. An additional 6 have just crossed into Israel. So that completes the expected hostage release for tonight. And that sets the scene probably in the coming hour or two for the release of around 30 Palestinian prisoners from Israeli jails. So that's a successful 7th exchange of hostages and prisoners.
But as you just said, as things stand on the 7th and final day of this temporary truce, that's it for now as far as things stand.
Well, we have not got any word at the moment of any further extension of the truce. There was a slight suggestion on one of the Israeli networks that another 24-hour truce might be available. Our impression from the Hamas side is that the chances are low of that happening. We may not know that for several hours yet. It wasn't until around just before 7 o'clock this morning, Israel time, that we knew that even today's exchange was going to take place. So, you know, let's not write it off just yet. But with the last group of hostages to emerge tonight, we now think that all the children who were snatched on October the 7th have now been accounted for, except the two little Bibas boys, the 4-year-old and the 10-month-old, who Hamas said yesterday they believed were dead. We have still not got any confirmation of that, but I don't think anyone is in Israel is expecting to see them emerge alive.
Can I just talk to you about Antony Blinken, the US Secretary of State? He's been in Israel most of the day. He met with Benjamin Netanyahu yet again. Is there any kind of subtle shift in the US position? I mean, this statement that the protection of civilians must be ensured before military operations restart, or has that always been the stance?
No, I think this is the most public and obvious statement of American intent that we have seen so far. There have been mutterings from unnamed US officials in the papers in the last few days. But here was Antony Blinken standing on Israeli soil saying, look, Israel, if you're going to go back to war in the southern Gaza Strip, as everyone expects Israel to do, then here's how you're going to do it. You're going to have a plan before you even start, a humanitarian civilian protection plan with what he called clearly and precisely designated areas of central and southern Gaza where civilians can be out of the line of fire. That's way beyond the single safe area that the Israelis have been talking about in recent weeks. And then when the fighting comes, he says it must not target critical infrastructure, including, crucially, hospitals and water facilities. Large numbers of people must not be forced to move, as we saw in the northern Gaza Strip. In other words, he's saying, if you're going to do this, you, one of the most powerful militaries in the world, you can do it while minimizing harm to innocent civilians. And we, your American allies, will be watching.
Paul Adams reporting from Jerusalem. Well, let's step away from the war in Israel and Gaza now, but stay in the Middle East, because the warnings are stark, but the pressure is climbing as world leaders gather in that region for the annual UN conference on climate change. The COP28 meeting, as it's known, got underway in the UAE with a renewed call for urgency from the UN's meteorological organisation. It said this year is set to be the hottest on record. Now, in the next few minutes, we're going to hear about how three countries are dealing with the impact of climate change. But first, an agreement was unveiled on day one of the conference for richer nations to provide funds to poorer or less developed countries to help them deal with the impact of things like severe weather. The Loss and Damage Fund, as it's known, is worth several hundred million dollars. The head of the talks in Dubai, Sultan Ahmed Al-Jaber, hailed the deal.
That we have been able to achieve such significant milestone in the first day of this COP is unprecedented. This is historic.
Well, our environment correspondent Matt McGrath is at the COP meeting in Dubai, and he told me more about the new agreement.
It's something that developing countries have been campaigning for 30 years. It's essentially a fund that will help them to cope with the impacts they're experiencing from climate change-related weather events right now. At the moment, a lot of developing countries do get climate finance, but it mainly goes to help them to transition away from using coal, oil and gas, to help them build wind tunnels or wind turbines and solar panels. It also helps them to build seawalls and other defences, so it helps them to mitigate and adapt to climate change. It doesn't help them with the impacts of climate change right now, and that's something that's been a sore point for a long time. It wasn't even allowed to be discussed at COP meetings over the last number of decades. Last year that changed, an agreement was reached, and today, in a really surprise move, countries agreed to set this fund up and get it going, and actually to put some money in it. Quite a significant chunk of money gone into it today. We expect more in the coming days.
So that's a good start to what's going to be a weeks-long conference, though. Tell us, what is the big challenge? What is it that some parties want settled by the time this thing wraps up and others are more concerned about?
The bigger question overarching all this is the future of fossil fuels, because if you remember back at COP26 in Glasgow, we had a first mention, really, of fossil fuels by countries talking about climate. They talked about getting rid or phasing down unabated coal. Now, countries want to go much further. They want to get rid of coal, oil and gas in some time in the future, and they want countries to agree to some sort of timeline here in meeting in Dubai. Now, that's it may not happen, but there's a lot of push for it. And after what's happened today on loss and damage, who knows what might happen. I think it's certainly changed the mood around here. It's changed the perception. People suddenly see things that were almost impossible becoming true. So I think it would be foolish to write off the chances of the end of fossil fuels coming at this particular meeting. It might be a bridge too far as well, but I think there'll be a significant push to get some language that says fossil fuels really have no long-term future.
And yet, we have a reminder today from the UN's World Meteorological Organization talking about a deafening cacophony of broken records on climate change. I mean, there's an urgency here, isn't there? Is there really a sense that an agreement about fossil fuels 5 or 10 years down the line is going to deal with a problem that needs dealing with something immediately?
I think great awareness here and a great motivation by reports like that came out today from the WMO. You know, it's all about history. There's a great sense here that things are moving much more quickly than they used to. You know, when the Paris Agreement was signed in 2015, the words fossil fuels weren't in it. Here we are 8 years later talking about perhaps the end of fossil fuels. So there's been a significant change. You're getting almost 200 countries to agree unanimously on the steps forward on climate change. And, you know, we will see, I imagine, in the next couple of days, a number of other agreements on methane, on renewable energy, on a number of things that may not come up to the top mark in terms of getting rid of fossil fuels, but there will certainly be benchmarks, important benchmarks along the way to that, what might be an inevitability at this stage.
Matt McGrath, who is at the climate talks in Dubai. Well, as I said earlier, we are going to hear from or about three countries dealing with the impact of climate change. India is crucial to the global effort to limit and then lessen carbon emissions. But even as the summit got underway, India confirmed its commitment to coal, the dirtiest of the fossil fuels, as a key source of energy in its future. Here's our business reporter, David Waddell.
With 1.4 billion people, India is now the most populous nation on Earth, and it's reliant on strong economic growth to improve the prosperity of its people. For growth, it needs power. And for power, it's pledged to continue burning this dirty fossil fuel for years to come. India depends on coal for nearly three-quarters of its energy needs. Now it's rushing to add 17 gigawatts of coal-based power generation capacity to meet a record increase in energy demand that would serve many millions of homes. India, along with China, are against any attempt to block construction of their coal-fired power stations. They argue that historically they've contributed far less to global emissions compared to developed countries, and a significant portion of India's population still lacks access to reliable electricity.
Well, next, there's Fiji, which is one of the most vulnerable countries. The South Pacific archipelago is made up of more than 300 islands. Drew Slater, who's an environmental activist from Fiji, says the effects of climate change are a constant threat.
Climate change is the greatest crisis to face us so far. It's the greatest crisis hitting the Pacific at the moment. Climate change affects us in many ways. There are fast onset ways like tropical cyclones, saltwater inundation, and there are slow onset ways like sea level rise. Those impacts and disasters affect us not only physically, our islands, but they affect us economically, our ability to recover, our ability to sustain ourselves. Agriculturally, they affect our crops, they affect the coral reefs that protect our islands, and they also affect the ability to retain our culture, to retain our heritage, because when land is destroyed, many cultures that are tied to the land are also at risk.
Well, finally, climate change is also causing big problems in East Africa, where more than 1 million people have been forced to abandon their homes because of severe flooding. More than 270 people have been killed in recent heavy rains. Here's our senior Africa correspondent, Anne Soy.
In Somalia alone, more than 100 people have died in flash floods. Whole towns have been submerged, forcing nearly their entire population to seek shelter elsewhere. These are people who faced the worst drought in decades in recent years, now having to deal with the impact of more severe weather. President Hassan Sheikh Mahmoud has said the country is in a critical state. Neighbouring Ethiopia and Kenya are also dealing with widespread floods. The situation is expected to get more dire as heavy rains are predicted to continue to early next year. The World Food Programme says the situation compounds the food security crisis in the region. There are also fears of outbreaks of disease. Humanitarian organisations are calling on world leaders meeting at the UN Climate Conference, COP28, to remember countries like those in the Horn of Africa, which are vulnerable to the effects of climate change, yet they contribute least to it.
And soy. Still to come.
The problem is that Tesla has refused to sign one of these collective agreements. And that's why more than 100 mechanics were reported to have walked out of workshops at the end of October.
So, has Tesla, the EV giant, met its match in Sweden? A trade union challenge is brewing there. Now, Brazil is sending military reinforcements to its northern border as tensions rise between its neighbours Venezuela and Guyana over a disputed oil-rich region. Venezuela is holding a referendum on Sunday as it seeks to affirm its claim to sovereignty over the Essequibo region, which makes up two-thirds of Guyana's territory. Warren Bull has more.
Brazil's defence minister, José Múcio, said his country was sending a further 60 soldiers to the border town of Pacaraima, almost doubling its deployment there. The Ministry of Defence said it wanted to avoid any transit of Venezuelan soldiers through Brazilian territory. Brazilian media reports say there are concerns the Venezuelan military could invade Essequibo following Sunday's referendum result. Guyana's government has called for Caracas to cancel the referendum, saying it poses an existential threat to the former British territory. But President Nicolas Maduro says it will bolster Venezuela's historical claims to the region.
Warren Bull reporting. A court in the United States has reinstated a gag order against the former president, Donald Trump. It means that he is, once again, banned from speaking out against court staff in his ongoing civil fraud trial in New York City. Mr. Trump's lawyers had argued that the order was unconstitutional. I asked our North America correspondent Neda Torfik what exactly got Donald Trump in trouble in the first place.
Quite literally, on the second day of this trial, this gag order was originally imposed because Donald Trump had gone off on his social media platform accusing the judge's top clerk of political bias, of being in a relationship with a Democratic senator, Chuck Schumer, without any evidence of that, accusing her of being a Democratic partisan. And so the judge imposed this gag order and later extended it to his lawyers as well. And Donald Trump was fined twice for violating that order, having to pay $15,000, and warned that in the future he could be met with steeper penalties, could even be imprisoned if he continued to violate it.
So is he going to stick by this, Neda? Are they confident he's going to abide by it?
Well, the judge today said that he would be vigorously and rigorously imposing it. So Donald Trump in the past had tried to find ways to skirt around it. In that brief time when the gag order was paused, he continued his attacks on the clerk. So we'll just have to wait and see how Donald Trump handles this.
And just quickly, Neda, if he doesn't abide by it, what is the sanction?
Well, the judge said he would even consider potentially imprisonment already. He has, as I said, had quite hefty fines, $15,000 twice already. And I should just also note that in court today, there was another development, just a note from the judge that he would issue a verdict in this case at the end of January at the earliest. We expect Donald Trump to testify for the defense on December 11th, and we will have some closing arguments on January 11th, and as I say, a verdict as early as the end of January.
Neda Torfik in New York. The United Nations has condemned a ruling by Russia's Supreme Court that appears to ban LGBT activism. The judgment backs a move by the Justice Department to declare the international lesbian, gay, bisexual and transgender movement as an extremist organisation, even though no such group actually exists. Campaigners in Russia fear the law will be used to jail anyone who promotes the rights of sexual and gender minorities. Here's our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg.
In Moscow, I once attended the trial of a man who died 3 years earlier. I recalled that today, as Russia's Supreme Court was deciding whether to ban an organisation that doesn't exist. The judge declared the International LGBT Public Movement an extremist organisation and banned it in Russia, even though human rights activists had written to the court to point out that there isn't an international LGBT public movement. But what there is now is concern amongst LGBT people here that the authorities will use this ruling to punish any form of LGBT activism in Russia. There's politics at play here. The state seeks enemies, scapegoats, to divert attention from problems at home. NATO, America, LGBT. What's more, ahead of next March's presidential election, in which Vladimir Putin is expected to run, the Kremlin leader has been making traditional family values his thing. LGBT activists like Maxime Goldman, who's been supporting transgender and non-binary people, see no future for themselves in their own country.
I feel completely rejected by my own country. The people we put in power are meant to take care of us. But the opposite is happening. They're punishing us. They're wiping their feet on us. I'm being forced out.
Maxime has packed his whole life into one small case and heads to the airport, not knowing if he'll ever be able to return home.
Steve Rosenberg in Moscow. Here in the UK, the author of a new book on the British royal family has denied naming two members who allegedly asked about the skin colour of Prince Harry and Meghan's first child. The Duke and Duchess of Sussex have previously said a royal asked about their child's skin colour while Meghan was pregnant with their son Archie. The Dutch version of the journalist Omid Scobie's book Endgame, which identified the royals, was pulled from shelves almost as soon as it was published 3 days ago. Our royal correspondent Johnny Diamond has more.
A controversy the palace hoped had been laid to rest has flared up again. The English version of Omid Scobie's book about the royal family made no mention as to which member of the family is alleged to have inquired after the possible skin colour of Meghan's first child. But the Dutch version, swiftly withdrawn from sale, had half a paragraph which included their names. Speaking on ITV's This Morning, Mr. Scobie denied responsibility.
It's frustrating that now what's going on in the Netherlands with the book that was obviously immediately rescinded and is now being reprinted has happened, and I'm glad to hear so. I had never submitted a book that had their names in it.
Quite how or why the names were included in the Dutch version of the book is not clear. Originally, a mistranslation was blamed, though the publishers now speak simply of an error. The palace remains silent, partly for fear of fueling the controversy, partly because though the names are swirling around social media, most broadcasters and newspapers are not publishing them, and partly because the issue remains, the palace says, a private family matter.
Johnny Diamond. Now, the US car company Tesla is facing a growing showdown with trade unions in Sweden in a dispute that is pitting Elon Musk's way of doing business against one of Europe's strongest workers' movements. A strike by a handful of Tesla mechanics over pay negotiations has led to walkouts by workers in other sectors linked to the carmaker, which is disrupting business in a region where electric vehicles sell very well. I got more from Maddie Savage, who's in Stockholm.
So in Sweden, there's a really strong union culture, and 90% of workers are covered by what's called a collective bargaining agreement, which looks into these issues. And so a union essentially lobbies for your working conditions. The problem is that Tesla has refused to sign one of these collective agreements. And that's why more than 100 mechanics were reported to have walked out of workshops at the end of October, and a lot of them still on strike. I spoke to EF Metal a couple of hours ago. They told me they believe around 60 workers are still not showing up for work. And strikes are completely legal in Sweden, which means they can essentially carry on doing that for as long as they want to.
I mean, I've seen a quote of Elon Musk, head of Tesla, describing this action as insane. But it really does seem to be pitting kind of arch capitalist against Sweden and Europe's more embedded union movement and the protections that come with it. I mean, who's going to budge here?
It's really difficult to say. I mean, it is, as you say, something of a stalemate between two very different ways of doing business. When you look at the Swedish model, it's all about consensus. It's about union agreement. It's about coming to decisions that everybody is happy with. Whereas Tesla's a much more of an American top-down organization. We have seen some legal action taking place this week with a Swedish court actually ruling in favor of Tesla. And this is because other workers started going on sympathy strikes from different industries, including postal workers who refused to deliver the license plates for Tesla vehicles. So this was quite a complicated situation because the Swedish Transport Agency had an agreement to use this particular carrier. But now a Swedish court has said that Tesla should be able to collect the plates directly as part of a process to try and help them to be able to continue selling Tesla cars in Sweden.
Can I ask you a bit more about that kind of secondary or sympathy action as you described it? I mean, I think that is ostensibly outlawed in the UK and other countries, but that's permitted, is it, and allowed in Sweden?
Yes, several other unions alongside EF Metall and the postal workers have organised sympathy strikes. That is legal in Sweden. And I think it's important to say that, by the way, if you go on strike in Sweden, you still get paid. And these strong unions like EF Metall, they've told me that they want the situation to be that if these strikes need to continue in the long term, they can. They believe that we could well see others being involved in sympathy strikes. But others, if you follow the Swedish media, have said they're less sure about how much of a huge impact this has had. And we are even seeing some Tesla workers speaking out in the Swedish media and saying, well, they're actually happy with their conditions.
Maddie Savage in Stockholm. Right, that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. As always, the address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Nick Randall. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Robin Brandt. Until the next time, thanks for listening and goodbye.